For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, we've been calling this the backward wisdom of God. I put backward in quotes because we're the ones who are really backward, right? We're the ones who often get lost and have a limited perspective and aren't seeing clearly. So when we hear God's perspective on the truth, it often sounds backward. It sounds, you know, counterintuitive. Now, one backward truth we're going to study this morning is regarding leadership. Like, how do we evaluate what an effective leader is and what they do? And I've summarized it kind of cryptically. I've just put the way up with regard to leadership, the way up is down. And I'll kind of unpack that as we go through. Now, as you think about different leaders, that's that Apple guy, Jobs. I always want to say Jobs, Steve Jobs. He's a business leader. You guys know who this is? It's Angela Merkel, German chancellor. So as we look at these different leaders, you know, there's a field general, Peyton Manning, very good, very effective leader, at least in football. MLK, Margaret Thatcher. We look at these leaders, and I don't know what your opinions of these different individuals are. Or how you would evaluate their effectiveness as leaders. Maybe you look to wisdom or strength or fortitude or courage or an ability to listen and build coalitions. I'm not sure. I mean, we all have different criteria for recognizing true leaders. In the Bible, the criteria is really striking. This would be a good way to put it. Jesus says, if you want to be first, or whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. So if you're scanning around looking for a good leader to recognize, you should be looking for a slave. Someone whose disposition is to serve people around them, to be at their disposal, to be intent on enriching other people. An attitude of a servant. According to Jesus, that's the true hallmark of a leader, the kind of leader that God values. And, you know, so in a sense, he's saying the way up to leadership is down the path of service. And you see this really spun out. And we're going to just, two simple things. We're just going to look at how Jesus' view of leadership really differed from that of his disciples. We're going to just go through Matthew 20, verses 17 through 28, just looking at two conversations Jesus had with the disciples that really reveal Jesus' attitude toward leadership. And then we're going to just look at the implications for us. That's all we're going to do. So let's go to Matthew 20 and just look at this interaction. Now, before we get into the actual text, let me give you a little background. Jesus has this talk with his disciples toward the end of his ministry. He's kind of riding a groundswell of popularity. It says in Matthew 19, verse 2, that large crowds were following him. You know, groups larger than this. You know, as Jesus would go speak in public or walk from one village to the next, people were coming from all over the region just to be around him, maybe to watch him heal somebody or do a miracle. And he was super popular. It had to be kind of a heady time for the disciples to follow somebody of his stature. To add to this, it says in Matthew 19, Jesus said, when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you shall also sit upon 12 thrones. Son of Man is a title Jesus used for himself. And he said, someday I'm going to reign as a king. And he told his disciples, and you'll be in positions of leadership with me. So what would have it been like heading up toward Jerusalem with Jesus as his popularity grows and grows? You know, walking through crowds of people, seeing him do miracles, and just being in his authoritative presence. What would have it felt like as one of the disciples? I think they would have felt like, you know, the aides to a successful presidential candidate on the eve of his election. You know, that sense that our guy or our girl's about to come to power. And when they do, we will also be in power. There's that, just these were heady times for them. And Jesus was aware of this. This is something he was worried about, that the men around him would basically start, you know, posturing and jostling to get in positions of power as Jesus got closer and closer to power. And so many different times in the Gospels, Jesus told his disciples something like this. He said, "Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men." You know, let this sink in, he said. Hear me on this. The mission I'm on right now, the mission I'm with you on to Jerusalem, it's not going to end in a throne. It's not going to end in an earthly kingdom. I'm going to be delivered over to people, and I'm going to die. And he said that there's 15 different places in the Gospels where he says this. He was intent on them getting this. Unfortunately, the disciples were so caught up in his groundswell of popularity, all they could think about was their future positions of rule. And as that kind of critical mass built, you could tell they started scrapping and fighting to position themselves to get into power. It really comes to a head in the passage we're going to look at. But right before, for the umpteenth time, Jesus says the very same thing. In Matthew 20:17, it says, as Jesus was about to go to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves, and on the way he said, "Behold, we're going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man is going to be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they're going to condemn him to death. And they're going to hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him. And on the third day, he'll be raised up." You know, he's looking at him. Maybe he circled him up at the road, you know, on the way to Jerusalem. And he's like, what do you think we're going here to do? You think there's going to be some like high seat for you to sit in? That's not the purpose of this mission. I'm going to get whipped and beaten, and I'm going to die. And I'm doing this as an act of service for the world, as a way of bringing them back into a right relationship with God. Don't mistake what we're trying to do. And yet, you know, the disciples still, they just didn't get it. This is where it gets really pathetic. Realizing, you know, the time is right to try to get their slice of the power pie. It says, "The mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, 'What do you wish?' And she said, 'Command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right and one on your left.'" I mean, just, I can't believe I'm even reading this. The mother of the sons of Zebedee makes this pitch. So, you know, their first move is budding, you know, leaders in the New World Order is to get their mom to approach Jesus. Yeah, that's promising. And, you know, you'd think they'd start maybe small, but no. According to this, his right and his left hand, they want to be second and third command over the entire planet. That's what they're asking for here. And what's even more pathetic, their mom's kneeling and bowing before Jesus, her supposed humility. Is that supposed to trick Jesus so he can't see their pride? I mean, come on. This is such a naked grab for power. That's all this is. And in this, I think we see a huge contrast between the way Jesus viewed leadership and the way these guys viewed leadership. Right? Jesus was determined to give. It says in Luke that he set his face toward Jerusalem, and he was determined to go there, to give his life for us, to pay for our sins on the cross. That's what his leadership looked like. But the disciples, especially James and John, they were just as determined to take. They were there to take power and prestige to themselves. I mean, so here we've really got to choose, you know, what kind of leadership path we want to follow. And I hope you realize, you know, as you feel your guts churning out of disgust at some of the shameless power-grabbing things that political leaders do, or sports figures, or people in academia, or whatever. When you've looked and just been like, ah, I just can't believe how shameless people are about grabbing power, you're not the only one who's turned off. God's turned off. God's view of leadership is different. He wants to lead in order to serve. He wants to lead so he can give his life for you and enrich your life. And if you don't know Christ, I would just appeal to you. You know, God does want to lead. He wants to lead you. And he's a leader worth following. He's not like other leaders in the world that disgust you. He's different. So how am I going to respond? How would Jesus respond to this? You know, it says in Proverbs that, I think it's Proverbs 16, verse 5, it says, God despises the proud. And you'd think at this point Jesus would just, you know, let him have it. But he's incredibly patient. Jesus answers and says, You don't know what you're asking. You have no clue what you've just asked me to do. And then he says, are you really able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink? He's like, you want a leadership role? Okay. I associate leadership roles with this cup, with suffering. That's what he's saying. You know, when I envision leadership, Jesus says, I connect it to this hardship, to difficulties. What was Jesus about to face? His cup was filled with God's wrath, God's anger toward all of human sin. And he was getting ready to drink that to the dregs, to bring it into himself, to be punished in our place. And he looks at him and says, are you ready to drink that cup? And astonishingly, they're like, oh yeah. We're so ready to do this. I don't know what to say. They say they're able, and you know, Jesus zings right back with a very sober comment. He says, all right, so be it. My cup you will drink. Now, these men did go on, James and John, they did go on to have leadership roles in the early church. And there was no throne for them to sit on. There was a lot of suffering and pain. James and John, you know, James, it says in Acts 12 that in the course of preaching the gospel, he was arrested by Herod, and Herod had him cut down, hacked to death with a sword. He's executed. John spent the rest of his life, toward the end of his life, like 20 years, something like that, in prison on an island called Patmos because the emperor Domitian wanted to shut him up. So they had their cup, and they drank it. Just like anybody who wants to serve Jesus and to lead like he does will. There is a cup associated with God's brand of leadership. Now, what's funny is, so they get the suffering, but the rest of the deal didn't work out too well. To sit on my right and my left, he says, that's not mine to give. That's for those to whom it's been prepared by my Father. So you will have the suffering. You won't have the leadership roles. Sorry. Okay, so that's what happens. Now, of course, at this point, we see another contrast, right? Another very stark contrast. Jesus was willing to suffer. It wasn't like he was eager to do it, but he was willing to suffer in order to serve. Remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was like, if there's any other way, you know, make this cup pass from me. And God said, no. The Father said, this is it. This is the only way. And Jesus was like, okay, I'll drink it. He was willing to suffer in order to serve. And certainly, if you want to get in a leadership role under God's economy, there will be suffering. People you're trying to care for will mistreat you or misrepresent you. You'll say things that people need to hear, and they'll hate you for saying it. It'll mean, you know, late nights. It'll mean your schedule's going to be disrupted. It'll, you know, it won't be convenient. Anybody that purposes to lead for God will have their own cup. But Jesus is saying, and many leaders would say, it's worth it for the opportunity, for the privilege to enrich somebody else's life. The disciples, on the other hand, these guys, they were willing to suffer to get the leadership position, right? They saw suffering as a way to pole vault into a position of power, and then they would get all the benefits. It's really in the objective where these perspectives on leadership differ. One is in order to serve. The other is in order to lead. One is as a willingness to serve so I can give. But the disciples want to lead so they can take. That's their perspective on leadership. You know, there were not just two disciples, there were 12, right? So the other 10 are watching this whole thing with the mom coming up and Jesus interacting, and they're upset. They don't like what they're seeing. If you look in Matthew 20:24, it says, hearing this, the 10 disciples became indignant with the two brothers. And don't get me wrong here. It's not like the 10 are saying, oh, wow, it's really a drag that James and John are such power-grabbing, you know, losers. And we're really upset that they're that way. The 10 were also power-grabbing losers, right? And they're worried that James and John are going to displace them and cut in front of them in line. That's what they're upset about. And this is all on the week before Jesus dies. And, you know, we know what happens after that. He's raised again and he leaves. He leaves his movement for this group of clowns to oversee. I mean, imagine how he would feel. He's, you know, I'm running out of time. And I just look at you guys and it's a mess. I mean, 3.5 years in this. That'd be pretty demoralizing. And so at this point, he just sits them down and says, all right, I'm going to directly address your flawed view of leadership. And so this is what he says. Jesus called them to himself and he said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them and the great men exercise authority over them, and it's not this way among you. Whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and if you wish to be first, you shall be a slave, just as the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. He points out, you know, I look at the world and I see the rulers of the Gentiles. I see worldly leaders. So that's what he means when he says Gentiles, the peoples of the world and the rulers that lead them. I look at those people, he says, and I see two things. They lord it over their subjects. And that has the clear sense of they lead to take, to benefit themselves. And I mean, all you have to do is look at history to see that that's true. How many, you know, rulers have lived in opulent luxury in their palaces while the people they're supposed to serve are in grinding poverty? Nothing could be more typical of human leadership than being out to take. And I think if you're honest with yourself, you know, I think we'd all admit we see some of that in our own hearts. We've seen that same spirit. Right? They're great men exercise authority. This isn't a neutral statement. It conveys the idea of compelling and oppressing people, forcing them to do our bidding. You know, putting them in a position where they're having to do for us whatever we tell them to do. He says that's worldly leadership. And I utterly reject it. Jesus Christ utterly rejects self-serving leadership. Leadership that's meant to amass a bunch of people, as many people as I possibly can, under me, to pull my wagon and do my bidding. That kind of leadership is something Jesus won't have. It's not going to be what defines the kingdom he establishes. He says the way to greatness is servanthood. The way to be first is to adopt the posture of a slave. The way up is down. That's God's backward wisdom. That's the way things are going to work when we're with God forever in heaven, when we're in his presence. That's the kind of kingdom he's going to establish. And if there's any doubt, he has his own example. Just as a big exclamation point, he modeled this principle by taking it all the way to the cross, all the way down to giving his life. That's the point that Paul makes in Philippians 2. This is servant leadership according to God. He says, don't do anything from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Don't merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ, who, although he existed in the form of God, didn't regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. That's radical. That's a radical commitment to servant leadership. God, in human form, lets go of the reins of power, adopts the posture of a slave, and dies for us. You know, as I was thinking about this teaching, I kind of paused as I was reflecting on this, and I just praise God that our leader is this way. Isn't it cool? That, you know, the guy that we're following, Jesus Christ, he's this kind of leader. I mean, what kind of kingdom would you want to be a part of? I want to be part of a kingdom where love and servanthood are the rule. This is such an awesome vision of what real leadership is about. And it's why we follow him. It's why we recognize Jesus as our leader. Look what Paul says in verse 9. It's for this reason. It's because of this that God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that's above every name. And I would appeal to you, if you're not sure what you think about Christ and you've had a bad taste in your mouth when you hear the term leader, soak that in. This is an invitation to come under the leadership of somebody who loves you and who's demonstrated that love by what he did on the cross. This is the kind of person I can follow and who's worth following. Another contrast here. I mean, what do we see? What we see is James and John wanting everybody under them. That's what they want. We want to be number two and number three over the whole world. Jesus instead, just like we read in Philippians, he got under everybody in order to serve. That's what spiritual leadership is about. So those are the contrasts. Hopefully that picture that God has, that the way up to leadership is down in service, hopefully that makes sense. Now let's talk about some implications of this. One implication is that Jesus is all about modeling servant leadership and hoping that you'll do the same. I mean, read the gospel sometime with a view to this. There's a scene in Mark 1 where nobody will touch this leper, and Jesus goes and heals him. He touches him and heals him. There's a scene, where a bunch of hungry crowds are up late and Jesus is preaching and his disciples are like, send him home. I'm hungry. I want to go to bed. And Jesus demands, no, we're going to stay here until everybody's fed. I think if you were able to be with Jesus during his ministry, you'd be struck by just how committed he was to enriching people and serving him. It's a scene where some kids want to come up to Jesus, and they want to receive a blessing from him. And the disciples are like, no, you can't approach Jesus. And it says Jesus gets angry, and he's like, I demand that you let these kids come to me. So this was his prime directive. This is what got him up out of bed. This is what his whole ministry was about. And obviously it was supremely modeled in the cross. And I want to spend just a little time talking specifically about what happened on the cross when Jesus drank that cup. Jesus mentioned it here at the end of our passage. He said, the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. The word ransom, it's a price you pay to set someone free who's in jail or who's imprisoned or held captive. At this time, if two warring armies fought and one army was able to capture the king of the other army, they would try to keep the king alive a lot of times and then demand that the opposing side come up with some huge ransom, you know. And we've got records like some countries would pay just pounds and hundreds of pounds of gold, an enormous amount of money, a king's ransom, right, to get their king back. And what Jesus is saying is he paid an enormous price for you. you know, sitting here, you're in a similar situation as a king that's captive. You're held captive because we're all under the judgment of God for sins that we've committed. We're all guilty before Him, guilty enough to face an eternity apart from Him. And the only way that can be dealt with is for Jesus to absorb God's punishment for our sin in our place. That's what that cup's all about. He drank down the punishment we deserve so that we could be forgiven. His ransom was higher than anything that was ever paid for a king, and He paid it for you with His own blood and His own life. And so there's an invitation here. This is one way we can begin to recognize His servant leadership, is to just call out to Him, thank Him for doing this, and ask Him to come into our life and forgive us. I hope you'd consider doing that. Okay, so there's that. The other thing is, everybody, all of us, should be engaging in servant leadership. Everyone. Now, you may be thinking, well, I'm not a leader. You're the leader. You're up there talking. I'm not a leader. What do you mean I engage in servant leadership? Well, all of us really are influencing other people. You ever been to a funeral where, you know, you see somebody's life being eulogized? A lot of times it takes a funeral, an extreme event, for us to recognize the impact an individual can have on the people around them. And you are impacting people. And God wants you to. He wants you to influence other people to follow Christ. And it could be in a variety of settings. It could be you're just in a conversation with a group of friends where you can be a servant leader. Or it could be in your family, modeling what it looks like to love and serve people to your own kids. Or it could be in a setting like in a home church where you're a home church leader or leading a Bible study with people at work or whatever it is. But you're already influencing, right? The question is, what kind of influence you're going to be? How are you going to lead in the place where God's already put you? Now, I realize one objection to this is, isn't it, you know, self-promoting for me to put myself forward as a leader? I think some of us feel hesitance based on that. I don't think so. Not if you remember what it is to lead in God's economy, right? If we understand leadership is spending myself to serve other people, that's not self-promotion. And I look around at some of the leaders in this room that are imitating Christ's style of leadership, I don't see power grabbing. I was thinking about a guy, Cliff Tryons. He goes to the first meeting here. He's been quietly agitating to get people to pray in RCTs. He's been doing that for years now. He's a key part of the prayer concerts, organizes all those. You'll see him out here praying for missions with Marianne Jaskalian, and he's sending us prayer updates. Is that a grab for power? No, that's a guy who's taken a God-given burden and decided, for the benefit of the community I'm part of, I want to see more people pray. That's not a grab for power. That's servant leadership. That's a good thing. It's not self-promoting. Let's say, here's a crazy thought. Let's say at some point God tapped you on the shoulder and said, you know, I'd like you to lead. Not just influence a few friends. I'd like you to lead a home church. Would it be self-promoting to agree to do that? No way. Not if you have your head on straight. Right, 1 Timothy 3:1 says it's a trustworthy statement. If you aspire to the office of overseer, it's a fine work you desire to do. If you're sitting here thinking, I'd like to lead, good. Leading is an opportunity to serve and give your life away to other people. And it's a good aspiration. Another thing you'll hear is, I'm afraid. You know, I sense God is kind of nudging me to lead, and it's the last thing I want to do. I don't want to lead in any capacity. I don't want to be out front. I don't want to be the one that everyone's looking at. Many of us feel this way. We feel like an invitation to lead is an invitation to humiliation and failure. And we're just frankly not interested. You know, if you're struggling with that, I would just say, be careful. I think there's a danger here. There's a type of pride like we see with James and John, that's, you know, self-asserting and out there to grab that high seat. But there, you know, that sees leadership as an ego boost. But there's another type of pride who, out of a desire to protect our ego, avoids anything that might lead to failure and humiliation. And I'm just saying, whether it's a power grab or avoidance of possible failure, that same spirit of the Gentiles, that same worldly view of wisdom is there. Because what are we saying? I'll lead as long as the outcome is beneficial, right? That's basically what we're saying. The truth is, servant leadership is humiliating. It is humbling. That's what we read in Philippians 2. There is a cup to bear. There is suffering associated with it. And people that you lead are going to misrepresent you. You're going to be insulted. There are going to be things that are painful associated with the type of leadership that we're called to pursue. And so I guess we need to talk about why then would I ever want to do that. But just realize this view of wisdom, this view of leadership, a worldly view can really creep in a lot of different ways. So you may be thinking, give me one good reason why I should pursue this. How about two? Actually, I had three, but I scaled it down to two. One is God has your back. He loved you enough to die for you, and he will not abandon you as you strike out to serve other people. Remember what Jesus told the disciples? He said, I'm going to go there to be whipped and beaten, and I'm going to die. But he said, on the third day, I'll rise again. God wasn't going to just abandon him. Out of his death would come new life. And this principle, life out of death, this is something God promises, that we will find new life, abundant life, as we die, you know, give ourselves away in the service of other people. There are so many promises that talk about this backward idea. If you lose your life for my sake, you'll find it. If you humble yourself, I'll exalt you. God looks after us. And ask somebody who's really struck out and lived the life of a servant leader. Or just look at their lives. What do you see? People that have adopted this course that I've seen, guys like Gary, he's off in Ireland, or just other folks who are living this way, I see a richness and an abundance and a vitality. I see something that I want. I don't see something easy, but I see real life and an abundant life, even in the midst of giving our lives away. So yeah. Keep that in mind. And what about this? Worldly leadership, it just doesn't work. How's it working for you to try to compel people to do what you want? Right? To try to assert yourself and get your way. How does it work in a relationship when you have two power-hungry people that are scrapping, you know, for control? What's that like? You know what it's like. It leads to death. It leads to pain. It leads to misery. What would really heal a lot of our relationships? It would be somebody determining to move in and out of a sense of wanting to follow Christ, willing to serve and initiate service with the other person. For some of us, our relationships will never get better until that happens. And so, yeah, there's two. I could think of more, but two's enough. All right, so we should engage in servant leadership for sure. How about you? Are you currently leading like a servant? And here I'm thinking more, you know, some of us are in positions of leadership in the church or maybe in your business. How are you carrying that out? These two guys, Blanchard and Hodges, they wrote a book, Lead Like Jesus. They say most leadership books focus on the leader's behavior and try to improve leadership style and methods. Emphasis is on the hands of the leader. You know, they attempt to change leadership from the outside. You know, if you can just use these five steps or, you know, the five strategies for effective leaders, whatever. They go on to say, yet in teaching people to lead like Jesus, we found that effective leadership starts on the inside. It's a heart issue. We believe if we don't get the heart right, then we simply won't ever become servant leaders like Jesus. And it is a question of the heart. You know, what am I in this for in the first place? So here's a couple questions to think about along those lines. Do you welcome criticism? you see leadership as a way to amass people under you, to get as many people admiring you as possible, then criticism is a direct threat. I mean, it makes you feel like all of that is crumbling. It's horrific. And, you know, I've had stretches where I just can't hear negative comments because I'm so intent on building my little empire. It's hard. It's hard to take criticism from a worldly leadership perspective. On the other hand, if you really want to become more skilled at loving people, then you welcome criticism. I was just talking to a guy who's working in Renegade with some low-income kids, and he's been going around asking people to give him feedback so he can be more effective at making disciples and helping these students follow Christ. You know, he's so intent on, I want to help these students. I'll, you know, rip me to shreds. I want to hear it. I want to get better at this because I care about them. That's a guy that's going to be powerfully used in God's kingdom. Do you think about people when you're not with them? If you really have a servant leader's perspective, then people will be on your mind. A worldly leader who's out to take, you know, they don't have time to think about other people. I think about stuff that I care about, and man, it's true. Even when I'm not around it, I think about it constantly. I think I've mentioned in past central teachings, I've been on a long-term battle with my lawn. My grass, you know, it's been, you know, just an eyesore. And I am slowly moving toward victory. If you look at most of my yard's under control, I've fertilized and weeded, but there is this patch that just galls me. It's around the patio, it's heavily shaded, and I tried to plant some grass this year in that area. I got out the peat moss and the fertilizer, I was watering it continuously, and it looked great until grubs wiped it out in the middle of July. It's just about dead now. But I'll tell you, during that stretch, I'd get up in the morning, there'd be birds pecking at the bird seed, or at the grass seed, and I'd be like, just want to kill you. Squirrels digging in there, my dog would go out there and mess up newly planted seed. Or it'd be really dry for a stretch, and I'd be drumming my fingers at work thinking, what's up with my grass? It's really hot. The sun's really hot. And I'd call my wife, Edith, can you water the grass? Because I was at work, of course. So you just care about it, and you think about it. And it's on your mind because you want to see it succeed, right? That type of kind of a healthy obsession. That's what a servant leader has. I remember as a young Christian, a guy who was trying to help me follow God took out a piece of paper, divided it into two columns, wrote out my strengths and weaknesses. He had spent part of his afternoon just thinking about me. And he wrote these strengths and weaknesses out. And, you know, I kept that piece of paper with me after he went over it with me for probably 20 years. I didn't carry it with me, but I would pull it out and look at it periodically. And I don't remember a lot of what he wrote, but I remember feeling like I'm in the presence of somebody who really cares about me. And that's often the distinction between an effective servant leader and just anybody, is servant leaders think about people when they're not with them. You look at, are you planning for your successor, or do you see yourself as indispensable? Let's think about this like as a home group leader. It's really easy to think, if I wasn't part of this group, it would collapse. I'm absolutely indispensable. And when we're thinking that way, what we've done is we've divorced ourselves from the true power source that makes this lifestyle possible. Nobody could live like Christ and be a servant leader just by their own wits and strength. God has to do this through you. It's a miracle when someone adopts this lifestyle. It's through the power of His Spirit, not just giving us the strength, but even the inclination to live this way. This is something that we have to plead with God to give us the strength to do. And when we realize that, we realize if this is all God, it doesn't matter if it's me or somebody else, anybody. God can use anyone He wants to influence this group for good. C.H. Spurgeon used to say, success can go to my head, and he had his share. He says, and it will go to my head unless I remember that it's God who can accomplish the work, that He can continue to do so without any help, and that He'll be able to make out with other means whenever He cuts me down to size. nice. And God will. I mean, sometimes he will fire us for a while to make that point. You know, home group leaders who want to see their groups grow and thrive need to elevate other people. They need to allow other people to have greater and greater influence over the group as they grow in Christ. That means they decrease, or they have to increase, and as leaders, we have to decrease. And that's hard on our ego, but that's part of servant leadership. Okay. The way up is down. Let's summarize just with a couple thoughts here. Servitude. I like that better because it has such a servitude. Better than service. Servitude is the true path to leadership greatness. The way up is down, for sure. But did you notice that Jesus doesn't rebuke James and John for wanting to be great? If you're sitting here and thinking, I'd like to be great, God wants you to be great as well. He built you for greatness. He really did. There's that part of you that wants to be impactful. That's a God-given thing. The Jesus' point, though, is that greatness comes from God. Even Jesus, he says, it's not for me to put you in the second and third chair. That's the Father's role. How dare we vault ourselves into similar positions? We've got to remember that God confers greatness and that that greatness comes through service. That's his whole point here. And I just would appeal to you, this is a rocky road, no doubt, but let's follow Jesus down it, down this road of humble service and trust him to lift us up. That's the Christian life right there. He'll give us the strength to do this. Just praise you for being such a good leader. Praise you for, going to the ultimate extreme to make our salvation possible. Thank you that it's not hard to be persuaded that you're trustworthy. You've demonstrated it, Lord. Help us trust you as we imitate you in this lifestyle. Thanks that you have our back and that you will, like you promised, Lord, that if we humble ourselves, you'll exalt us, and if we lose our life for your sake, we'll find it, God. Thank you for those promises. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.